one of our many shows this season, Martha Rossler, Bringing the War Home. With its great collections, the Worcester Art Museum is a great museum to visit any time, but we think right now it's really a special time to visit it, particularly because of our special exhibitions. We just opened last week An American Vision, Treasures from Winter Tour. This is a selection of works from the greatest collection of American decorative arts in the world, the DuPont Estate in Wilmington, Delaware. And we have about 365 objects over in the museum right now, the best of the best from the colonial period up to the Civil War. We also have a show drawn from our great collection of works on paper entitled Stencil. And this is a show we do from time to time focusing on printmaking techniques. In this case, it's a stencil, which some of you may know as serigraphy or silkscreen, and a chance to show some recent acquisitions to our permanent collection. And then we have two very, very timely shows. One is textile heirlooms from Indus Valley, which is a group of textiles from that part of the world which we hear so much about today, Pakistan, part of Afghanistan, and India. And these are works that were collected by Tom and Peggy Simons, who live here in Massachusetts. And Tom was ambassador to Pakistan from 1996 to 98. And we are really enjoying this show because it sheds another image on that country that, unfortunately, we see only a one-sided image today, the work of the women and such beautiful work. And then, of course, Martha Rossler bringing the war home. I want to thank, in particular, Susan Stoops, our curator, for bringing the show to Worcester. Susan does such a great job for us on overseeing art of the last 10 years. We try to be on the cutting edge, and Susan does that well and gives us a wonderful menu. In this case, she's brought together two series of works by Martha Rossler, who was a very visionary artist during the Vietnam War with her photo montages, and now she's come back and done a series on the Iraq War, and this is the first time These works are being seen together. Now, those of you come to this talk, you'll have a chance to see those exhibitions, the permanent collection as well, and your ticket will get you into the galleries and, of course, the reception that will follow, where you'll have a chance to meet one of our legendary figures, Howard Zinn. I do want to mention that the Martha Rossler Show, the exhibition, and the related programs are supported by the Don and Mary Melville Contemporary Art Fund, and also Worcester Magazine. We've had additional funding also from the Massachusetts Foundation for the Humanities. This is a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and also the Worcester Cultural Commission, which is a local agency supported by the Mass Cultural Council, which is a state agency. I also want to thank the folks here at Tuckerman Hall for letting us have this event here in this wonderful hall. Last month, we had Martha Rossler here for a talk in the gallery, and we were delighted. And today, we're thrilled to have the great historian, playwright, and social activist, Howard Zinn. Howard Zinn will talk about the parallels between Rossler's work and our nation's history with conflict. Raised in a working-class family in Brooklyn, he flew bombing missions for the U.S. Air Force in World War II, an experience which has shaped his opposition to war. On a GI Bill, he went to college and got his PhD from Columbia University. And in 1956, he was made professor at Spelman College in Atlanta, which is a school for black women. And there he got involved in the civil rights movement, participating as an advisor to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And when he was fired in 1963 for insubordination related to a protest work, he moved to my alma mater, Boston University, where he became a leading critic in the Vietnam War. He has also been a visiting professor for the University of Paris and the University of Bologna. Howard Zinn, as many of you know, is best known for his popular book, A People's History of the United States, which presents American history through the eyes of those Mr. Zinn feels are outside the political and economic establishment. His publications include many, such as Howard Zinn on War, Artists in Times of War, and You Can't Be Neutral on a Fast-Moving Train, A Personal History of Our Times. Howard Zinn has received many awards, just to name a few, the Thomas Merton Award, the Eugene V. Debs Award, the Upton Sinclair Award, and Lannan Literary Award. With no further ado, Won't you join me in welcoming Howard Zinn to Tuckerman Hall and the Worcester Art Museum, please?
Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you, Jim. Jim Whaley and Katrina Stacy just took me on a tour of the beautiful museum, and one of the great museums. I'd heard so much about it. This is the first time I really had a little glimpse of it. But I want to thank Jim and Katrina for inviting me here. I assume they were basically responsible. I mean, who else would invite me? So I will talk for a while. Oh, there's actually a clock here. Does it work? Is it? Let me see. Yeah. Okay. So I'll talk for a while, no more than 3 hours, and then we'll have some questions, and feel free in the question period. You don't have to agree with me. There are people who don't. We'll make a good back and forth session. Today is November 11th, right? Veterans Day. Well, it's celebrated, officially tomorrow, but it's November 11th, which is the original date, and some of you may know it was once called Armistice Day, which I prefer, actually, because, Armistice Day was established to celebrate the end of World War I. It wasn't set up to celebrate the coming of another war. It was celebrate to the end of World War I, went because it was 11 o'clock on November 11th, the 11th hour, the 11th day of the 11th month that marked the end of one of the most stupid wars in world history. And there have been many. World War I persuaded so many people that war could not be accepted anymore as a way of solving problems of the world. Einstein and Freud had a correspondence after World War I in which they discussed the whole question of how are we going to put an end to this monstrosity of war? Because, in World War I, 10 million men had died in the battlefields in Europe. Absurd, absurd battles in which 100,000 men died for 50 feet of ground. And at the end of 4 years of war and all those dead, nobody could figure out why the war was fought. So there's a reaction to World War I. And people were discussing how we can avoid that. And we had anti-war literature. We had John Dos Passos and Ernest Hemingway and over Germany, Erich Remarque writing All Quiet on the Western Front. And here in this country, in between the two wars, we had Dalton Trumbo, a Hollywood screenwriter, blacklisted, which means he was good. And Dalton Trumbo wrote what may be the most powerful anti-war novel I have ever read, called Johnny Got His Gun. If you haven't read that book, you should. Johnny Got His Gun. Then World War II came along and gave war a good name. Really, it's an interesting phenomenon. Because World War II was about, there you had the epitome of evil in fascism and Hitler and Mussolini and the Japanese military machine. which led me, although I had read Dalton Trumbo's book and became convinced that war was a horror that could not be repeated for any reason, but there was fascism in Europe. And what could be a more clear-cut cause than to fight fascism? And so I volunteered for the Air Force, and I became a bombardier, and I flew bombing missions in Europe, and I dropped bombs on various cities. And then when I came out of the war, after being an enthusiastic bombardier, I began to think about the war, the best of wars. World War II was the best. It was the greatest. It's still the greatest, you know that. It's very hard to say anything critical about World War II. This is the greatest generation. This is the war about which movies are made, and the heroics of D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge and, you know, and Iwo Jima and all the heroism accompanying World War II, and there was, of course, there's always heroism in war, you see. And yet, at the end of the war, after I'd completed my missions and I was on my way home, I wrote on my little folder, it was a folder something like this, in which I had put my sort of little mementos, my old navigation logs and other little photos and so on, and I wrote on it, "Never again," without even thinking. Never again after the good war. And then I've spent a lot of time in the years since thinking about war and thinking about World War II, because I decided that if you are going to tackle the idea of war for humanitarian reasons and for good reasons, because war is always presented that way. Everybody agrees about the horrors of war. There's no problem about that. But people are willing to accept the horrors of war so long as it's for a good cause. So I wanted to take a war where the cause was the best, you know, the cause of World War II, and examine that war. And see if it stood up to moral scrutiny. See if even that, the best of wars, was something that should be re-examined and examined, and the question asked, is war the way to solve the problems that we have in the world today? And I came to the conclusion that war can no longer be accepted. Whatever the situation was in World War II, fascism and all of it, war can no longer be accepted as a way of solving any problems in the world. Whatever tyranny there is, whatever invasion takes place of whatever country, war cannot be accepted as a solution, because war always makes things worse than they were before. War, even wars for presumably good causes, wars always poison everyone who engages in them. They are the bad guys, and we are the good guys. And then you go to war, and the good guys begin acting like the bad guys. Really. Hitler was, and this was one of the reasons, you know, for going to war. Hitler and Mussolini and the Japanese, they were bombing civilians' populations in cities, and we were horrified. Horrified. This was something new. War was something between soldiers, between armies. And here the Germans were bombing Rotterdam and London, and the Italians had been bombing Addis Ababa in Ethiopia and Madrid in the Spanish Civil War, civilian populations, and we were horrified. This is not what humane people do. And then we entered the war, and then we began bombing civilian populations on an even greater scale than the fascists had done. You know, bombing Dresden, 100,000 people. Oh, well, some people say only 35,000 people. Nobody knows. Does it matter? A lot of people died. Read Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse 5. Get a picture of Dresden. And Hamburg and Frankfurt, 30,000, 35,000 people killed in one night. Tokyo, firebombing of Tokyo, 100,000 in one night of bombing, Tokyo set ablaze. Mostly women and children, old people. You know. And then, of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which some people still defend. You know, it's a very interesting psychological process by which people can defend the indefensible. How can you defend the killing of several hundred thousand people? For what? Well, there's a reason for it. You always find a reason. It's made the human mind, which is capable of so many remarkable things, is also capable of rationalizing the greatest of evils. All people need is a reason, an excuse, and they will kill. They will kill by the hundreds of thousands. If all we need is a reason, when you examine that reason, very often the reason doesn't hold up. But even if there is a reason, the question remains, is there anything that can justify the killing of several hundred thousand people? I sometimes say to people who defend the bombing of Hiroshima, saying, well, you know, it saved lives. And there's a lot of nonsense written about that, of how many lives we saved and we would have had to invade Japan. I don't want to go into the details, except that I've done a lot of research on that. It's all nonsense. We didn't have to invade Japan. We didn't know. The figures were thrown out. Truman threw out figures. Presidents love to throw out figures. No. And I sometimes say to people who defend it, they say, well, it shortened the war. Oh, yes, Japan was about to surrender, but this shortened it. Well, you mean we would have had to wait a few months? Because that's what the strategic bombing survey of the official survey of the U.S. Army determined when they went into Japan and interviewed all the top-ranking Japanese officials, and they were told Japan would undoubtedly have surrendered within the next couple of months without the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So sometimes I'll say to people who defend the bombing, suppose you knew in August of 1945 that you could shorten the war by, who knows, 3 months or 4 months or 6 months. You could shorten the war by killing 100,000 American children. Would you do it? Well, the answer is obvious. No. But it's okay to kill 100,000 Japanese children in order to supposedly shorten the war. War does that to the human mind. It poisons the mind. It turns the enemy, and not just the leaders of the enemy, but the citizens of the enemy, the ordinary people, turns them into people who deserve to die. So, yes, I came out of World War II thinking war poisons everybody who engages in it. Yeah. You start off being the good guys, and soon you're the bad guys. And yes, there are monstrous evils on the other side, but you'd better find a way of dealing with that without committing great evils yourself. That's what I concluded. And of course, then I faced the wars that followed after World War II. What was interesting to me was that World War II, and this to me was the worst thing about World War II, it created the rationale for all the wars that followed. Because in all the wars that followed World War II, World War II was the model. It's because World War II had this goodness about it, this clear-cut, or what seemed clear-cut, moral support. And so every war since then was justified by using World War II as an analogy. The enemy was always Hitler. Ho Chi Minh was Hitler. Saddam Hussein was Hitler. All the, you know. Noriega in Panama, Hitler. Don't go to war. Oh, you're Chamberlain. You're appeasing. You're, you know, it's Munich. All the analogies connected to World War II. And so what I resented most was the World War II, which had some elements, yes, of the good war, was being used to justify all the obviously evil wars that followed World War II. And then something else was clear to me after the war, and that is you go to war presumably for certain ends, and they may look like noble ends. You know, fighting against Hitler, fighting against racism, you're fighting against aggression, you're fighting against militarism, because that's what Hitler represented. And then the war is over, and what do you find? Have you done away with racism? Have you done away with fascism? Have you done away with militarism? Have you done away with war? You look around the world, and this was important to me, because at the end of World War II, I received a letter from General Marshall, the general of generals, not exactly a personal letter. It was sent to, I think, 16 million veterans of World War II. But the letter said something like, "We have achieved a great victory. This will be a new world." It wasn't a new world. It hasn't been a new world. All of us know that. 50 million people dead in World War II, and we didn't do away with war or militarism. Sure, we did away with Hitler and the Japanese Empire, and now here we were with the United States and the Soviet Union playing monopoly with the world and building up their nuclear arsenals, which if used would have made Hitler's Holocaust look puny, and it came close to being used. So naturally I became an opponent of the Vietnam War. I've been an opponent of every war since. The war against Grenada, you remember the war against Grenada? That was a real contest. A lot of medals were given. There were more medals given away for that heroic victory over Grenada than there were people on Grenada, you see. You know, war against Panama, do you remember that? Another heroic victory. Why are we making war against Panama? Well, there's, you know, Noriega, there's a drug trade. Of course, they neglected to say Noriega had worked for the CIA. It's amazing how many tyrants have worked for the CIA, and then at a certain point they become the enemy. So we go to war, presumably, to end the drug trade in Panama, and no big deal. We just, you know, bomb Panama City, kill a few thousand people, destroy neighborhoods. Read John le Carré's book, The Tailor of Panama. It's a novel. John le Carré is, you know, a lot of fun to read, but he's also a serious writer. And in this fictionalized version of what happens in Panama, there's just a short number of pages in which he describes the bombing of Panama City. And then we win, of course. Well, it wasn't exactly an equal contest, the United States and Panama, you'd say. Did we end the drug trade? No. War has unintended consequences. You don't know when you go to war what the end result will be. But you're led to believe there will be a good result by the people who lead you to war. So here we are on Veterans Day, and I noticed there was an item in the newspapers. Or maybe it wasn't in the newspapers. More and more these days, I get something on the internet. I'm a late addition to the internet. My son taught me about the internet, as you know, the kids teach us about modern technology, you say. And so I find things on the internet, and then I look in the newspapers to see if they're there. They're not there. Our newspapers are very unreliable sources of information. Television is a very unreliable source of information. This was an item which I got over the internet about how in Florida, there was a teacher in a school in Florida who, in preparation for Veterans Day, had his students create a banner. That's art, right? Deserves a place in the Worcester Art Museum. A banner celebrating conscientious objectors. Well, Veterans Day, you're not supposed to celebrate conscientious objectors, you're supposed to celebrate veterans. You're supposed to celebrate war, really, and the military. I mean, what else happens on Veterans Day? The parades and bugles and people put on their veterans' hats, and it's the atmosphere is not one of peace on Veterans Day. The atmosphere is one of militarism. And this teacher had the audacity to have a class work on a banner honoring conscientious objectors. Well, of course, from my point of view, that's what Veterans Day should be. Veterans Day should not be a day in which you honor, oh, sure, you honor veterans. The human beings who go to war deserve honor, but not because they were in a war. You don't want to perpetuate the idea that the great heroism is military heroism. And yet that idea is perpetuated by our culture. It's perpetuated even by the films that are supposed to be anti-war films. You know, you go to see Saving Private Ryan, and some people think, oh, it's an anti-war film because it shows the horrors of, you know, all the people dying on D-Day. But no, there's a kind of exaltation about being in a war, no matter how horrible it is, for good reason. And so I've always resented the use of Veterans Day as a way of bringing out the flags and the bugles and, you know. No, the best way to honor people who have been in war, and yes, people who have been in a war deserve to be honored, but the best way to honor them is by pledging that there'll be no more veterans, ever. No more veterans of any more wars, you see. A few years ago, I was invited to Washington, D.C., because they were unveiling, establishing a memorial for World War II veterans. And I spoke, and, you know, there were many tents set up and people in these tents, and I spoke to a bunch of people in a tent, and I said to them roughly something like this. I said, you know, there's all this stuff around us about celebrating, unfortunately, celebrating the war, not celebrating the human beings who are the victims of war, but celebrating war, you say, and honoring war, really. And I want to honor people who engage in war. I'm here really to honor. I had two very close friends in the Air Force. They were my closest friends in the Air Force. The three of us were sort of went all through training together, and then one of us went to the Pacific and one to Italy, and I went to England. We flew out of those places, and those two guys were killed. They were killed in the last weeks of the war. And I said, I'm here to honor Joe Perry and Ed Plotkin, these two guys, but I'm not here to honor war. So I think we have to look at Veterans Day, look at Memorial Day, and look at the culture of our time, which unfortunately celebrates military heroism. The reason for celebrating conscientious objection is precisely to send a message of peace and a message of no more wars. And the people who refuse to go to war have courage. Military courage, that's fighting, and that's one kind of courage. Protesting against war is another kind of courage, and a very important kind of courage. What happened when that teacher decided on this banner honoring conscientious objectors is that a parent of one of the students called in to Rush Limbaugh, who then went on the air in the great fury that a teacher should dare to honor conscientious objectors. And the result was there was a barrage of phone calls and emails to the principal of the school protesting against this teacher. And, in high schools, there's not very much democracy. High schools are in many ways totalitarian institutions. And teachers are subject to that atmosphere, and students are subject to that atmosphere. And, I mean, it's interesting, we live in a democracy, presumably. But in all the little spaces of the democracy, in the classroom, in the workplace, in the courtroom, in on the streets, in the places that make up the so-called democracy, these places are not democratic. And this, really, they're not, And so our job is to make them democratic. Our job is to take advantage of the claims that are made. It's claimed that we have freedom of speech. It's claimed that we have freedom of press. We have a Bill of Rights. Well, these are just claims. The reality of the world is that whoever has the power decides whether these claims will be fulfilled. And the only way they will be fulfilled, the only way we can actually ensure that we have freedom of speech is if we insist on it, if we resist it. If we are those students in the class who refuse to go along. And there were students, and here I'm drawing on another news item I read about a school in Chicago where the students staged a protest against the war in Iraq in the school cafeteria. They didn't throw food around. They just held up banners, right? But they were suspended from school for doing this. And so you wonder, what is our education about? Our education to teach conformity? Our education to teach obedience? These students who did this were representing a noble idea in American history, the idea of civil disobedience. Thoreau is considered one of the great literary figures of our time, but his essay on civil disobedience, when people carry it out, things happen to them. We all have the obligation to act out the Bill of Rights because the people who are in authority are not going to honor the Bill of Rights. So I was glad when, I don't know if it was a coincidence or it was deliberate, that I was invited to come here on Veterans Day to give me a chance to vent my feelings about war and about veterans. Is George Bush a veteran? What is he a veteran of? Is Cheney a veteran? When I think of, you can't be a conscious objector, but you can be somebody who tried to get out of the Vietnam War by getting into the National Guard, and then not showing up, or Cheney, who got out of the Vietnam War, and said, I had better things to do, really. Now, if they had been against the Vietnam War and got out of it, well, that's fine. That's what a lot of young people did. They were against the war and say they refused to go. But Cheney and Bush were not against the war. They were for the war. and they wouldn't go to fight. That's cowardice. Cowardice. You know. So we're all in a position of being unfortunately in a society that is filled with all the symbols of militarism and war and the recruiters coming around to the high schools to talk kids who may be desperate, because you know the recruiters don't go to posh prep schools. They go to working class high schools where they can talk to kids who don't know whether they're going to have a job or not and are looking for a career and hoping to get a free education, and they'll get a bonus of $5,000 or $10,000 if they join up, say. And, So we all of us are in a position as citizens, I think, of having a responsibility if we care about our country, about our ideals, to really defend those ideals by defying the authorities, defying those who want to stifle what we have to say. Now, I like to think beyond the war in Iraq. There's no point in my saying anything about the war in Iraq. By now, most Americans know that the war in Iraq is a disaster. Not just a disaster because we're losing. That's not the point. If we were winning, it would still be a disaster. Because we don't deserve to win or lose. We deserve not to be there. We shouldn't be there. It's not our country. The Iraqis, and poll after poll and survey after survey and so on, sure, the Iraqi people do not want us there. I mean, who wants an occupation force? Who wants an invasion which leads to several million Iraqis being forced to leave their homes? And it's interesting, here's Saddam Hussein, the brute, the tyrant, which he was. And oddly enough, we, by invading Iraq, have actually taken Saddam's crimes and multiplied them, responsible for more people dying and more people displaced than even this tyrant was able to do. So yes, most Americans now understand that the war in Iraq is a disaster, and some of them think it's because we're simply not winning, and others think because it's just wrong for us to be invading and occupying another country. But I like to think beyond the war in Iraq, because at some point the United States will have to leave Iraq. Occupiers eventually have to leave because they're not wanted. They have to leave. I don't know when we will leave Iraq. A lot of it will depend on whether the American people really rise up and insist that we leave Iraq. A lot of it will depend on whether our political candidates, even those who are supposedly against the war, like the leading Democratic candidates, depend on whether they develop the courage to say we have to leave Iraq and not do as these Democratic candidates are saying, well, if I get into office, maybe we'll leave in a year. And in fact, the three top candidates said that they would not guarantee that by the end of their first presidential term that all of our troops would be out of Iraq. This was shocking. But not surprising if you know American history. Because if you know American history, you know the Democratic Party has been as warlike as the Republican Party. We've never been able to depend on the election of another party to get us out of war. Really. You look at the history of the Vietnam War, the Democrats and Republicans carried on the war. Ironically, it was under a Republican that we actually got out of Vietnam, not under a Democrat. So what happens after we get out of Iraq? Well, there are obviously pressures now, even while we're fighting a war in Iraq, there are pressures now to start another war against Iran, which sounds on the face of it insane, because it is. But it's not unheard of for leaders of governments to engage in insane policies. And the reason is they don't care. Really, it's important to know this about governments. Governments don't care. One of the most, and here's what I mean about thinking beyond the war in Iraq. Thinking about certain basic facts about society that if known, will inoculate us against war. Not just this war, but any war that comes, Iran or whatever can come next. It's important for us to absorb certain important ideas. And our culture and our education, unfortunately, doesn't really teach us these ideas. But I'm going to present them to you. They're ideas I believe in. You don't have to believe in them, and you can contest them if you like, if I allow you to speak afterward. That's known as freedom of speech. You know, the speaker speaks for an hour, you get 1 minute, and that's the freedom of speech. Yes. But one of the important things that, and especially for the younger generations to know, to guard against the lure of militarism and war, one of the important things to know is that the interests of the government are not our interests. The interests of the government are not the interests of the citizens of the country. This is true not just in the United States, but it's true in governments around the world. If governments had the interests of the people in mind, then governments wouldn't have to lie as they do. The reason for lying is that if they told the truth, they would be overthrown very quickly. Their interests are not the same as ours. This is very strange to say in the United States. In the United States, we grow up with the idea that we all have a common interest. You know, this is America, and we have language in our culture which sort of tries to bind us together in one common interest. In fact, we have phrases like the national interest. And you will hear politicians say, well, I'm against war, but I'll only go for a war if it's in the national interest. Really? Whose interest? Is there one national interest? Is the interest of George Bush the same as the interest of the young guy he's exhorting to go to war? Is the interest of Exxon the same as the interest of the ordinary person in the United States? No. I mean, here's where American history is very useful if you get beyond the traditional rah-rah American history, unfortunately, that we get too often, and that is all through American history from the very beginning, from the Constitutional Convention, from the Revolutionary War on. The interest of the government has not been the same as the interest of the people. I mean, with all the honor given to the Constitution was not drafted and not put together for the interests of all the people. It was a very wise document and very important document and, you know, it established certain institutions and so on, but it was set up for the interests of bondholders and merchants and slave owners and land speculators. They were the people who were represented in the Constitutional Convention. Black people were not represented. Women were not represented. Working people were not represented. From the beginning of this country, there's been difference of interest between the people at the top and the rest of the population. If you don't understand that, then you won't be skeptical of authority. If you think that there's a common interest, there's such a thing as, oh, national defense, national interest, national security. Whose security? If you believe those phrases, well, then I suppose whatever the government says must be right because the government has our interests at heart. The government does not have our interests at heart. It's that very troubling thing when you think of it. It does not. The citizenry must have their own interest at heart. Whenever important problems of social justice had to be solved, they were not solved from the top. They were not solved by the initiative of the government. They were solved by citizens gathering together and creating social movements. You know. And, you know, all you have to do is look at a little American history, and you know the working people of this country were not protected by the government. In fact, certainly the Constitution did not protect working people, and still doesn't. Working people always had to defend themselves. Why do you think unions came into being? Unions came into being because working people were defenseless, not only against the corporations that owned their workplace, but against the government that sent out the troops to break the strikes and prevent them from unionizing. So workers had to create their own unions and their own struggles and fight against the National Guard and the police who were called out against them. The eight-hour day was not won by presidential decree or congressional enactment. It was won by working class in the late 19th century who went on strike all over the country for the eight-hour day. You know. And black people in the South did not do away with segregation in the South because there were liberal presidents like Kennedy and Johnson who did away with racial segregation. Hardly that. Kennedy and Johnson were not prepared to Kennedy and Johnson were not prepared to interfere with Southern white rule until black people rose all over the South and created such a commotion in the country which reached the ears of the world and embarrassed the governments of Kennedy and Johnson until finally, you know, things began to happen. You know, I lived through that period in the South, and it was very clear. Black people could not depend on the government. They had to do it themselves, and that's the lesson for all of us. Just as in the Vietnam War, although Kissinger got a Nobel Peace Prize, which forever besmirched the Nobel Peace Prize. Actually, I always wanted to use that word, besmirched. Finally got a chance. Kissinger besmirched the Nobel Peace Prize. He was one of the architects of the war, and he gets credit for bringing the war to an end. No, the war did not come to an end through the initiative of the government. The war came to an end because people in this country created a great movement, and because GIs over in Vietnam refused to fight anymore, because young people refused to go into the military, because ROTC chapters had to be disbanded, because soldiers deserted from the military, because soldiers began killing their officers in Vietnam, because the government could not depend on the army anymore. Airmen refused to fly missions over Hanoi and Haiphong. And so the war in Vietnam came to an end. But this is our lesson. No, the government interest and ours are not the same. We are on our own. And when you understand that, then you will look at everything the government says with suspicion. Maybe there are times when the government tells the truth. but the fact is that what history shows is the governments lie all the time. Really, every war has been accompanied by lies. Every war has been accompanied by, oh, we're going to war for this and we're going to war for that. And, you know, we're going into Mexico in 1846 to bring civilization to the Mexicans. No, we're going there to get their land. Took half of Mexico, really, at the end of the Mexican War. We're going into Cuba in 1898 to free the Cubans from Spanish rule. No. Yes, we got the Spaniards out of Cuba. We got ourselves into Cuba. By ourselves, I mean United Fruit. I mean Vanderbilt. I mean the railroads and the banks and, yeah, and so on. The lies, every war involving lies and deception. And so if you understand that the government does not have the interests of the people at heart, not in this country and not in other countries, you know, you will be very skeptical when the government tells you, well, this is a war on terrorism. That is the biggest fake there is, the so-called war on terrorism. You know, it's, you know. But, you know, for a while, a lot of people went along with this because it's very easy to build up a hysteria about, well, it happened during the Cold War. In the Cold War period, it was communism. Well, of course, yes, there was a Soviet Union. And there was, you know, and the Soviet Union did take over countries in Eastern Europe. But we magnified that into everything that happened in the world was somehow due to the Soviet Union and communism. So if there's a, if the people of Vietnam decide that they want to get rid of the French and want to run their own country, well, it's part of the world communist plot. You know, if the people of Guatemala elect a president that the United States doesn't like and the president has a few socialists hanging around, well, that's part of the world communist plot. Our foreign policy, all through the period of the Cold War, our invasion of other countries, our intervention in other countries, our secret overthrow of democratically elected governments, all came and was allowed because, oh, communism. That was the word that was the open gateway to whatever we wanted to do, and now the word is terrorism. It doesn't take much, and I think the American people have begun to get an understanding of this, because at first you swallow it, at first you're part of that hysteria. They blew up, yes, terrorists blew up the Twin Towers, and there is such a thing as terrorism. But then the question is, yes, there's terrorism. So what do you do about it? Well, Bush's answer was immediate. We're going to do something. We're going to declare war on terrorism. How are you going to do that? We're going to invade Afghanistan. We're going to bomb Afghanistan. And how will that do away with terrorism? Well, Osama bin Laden is somewhere in Afghanistan. We don't know where he is, but we'll bomb Afghanistan. So what's the result? We bomb and invade Afghanistan. Do we find Osama bin Laden? Do we diminish terrorism? No, we kill at least three. Well, how many people died in the Twin Towers? 3,000 people or so. We kill more than 3,000 people in our bombing of Afghanistan. And do we diminish terrorism? No, we increase terrorism. Do we diminish terrorism by going into Iraq? No, we increase terrorism. Because nobody, not just the government, but the press, the media, which, you know, you would think, oh, these are intelligent people. They work for the New York Times, the Washington Post. No, they're pitiful in the way they go along with whatever the government does, you know. The columnists are invited to breakfast at the White House. You know, they go to the National Press Club. They go to the briefings. And you've seen these briefings on television. Do they ask hard questions of the spokesman for the White House? Hardly, you know. And so they go, well, they don't ask questions. You know, when the war in Iraq started, they supported the war. Only now they're beginning to come around. It's amazing. Very often the press, the so-called educated press, comes around after the public comes around, not before. There was a... last year, there was a secret report leaked. What would we do without leaks? You know, the government, you know, but if the government was on our side, they wouldn't be hiding things. They're hiding things all the time. There was a report which was leaked about how the NIE, National Intelligence Estimate, which is something that's put together by a government agency out of all the various intelligence agencies, and what it said was that our war in Iraq has increased terrorism in the Middle East and in the world. This is the government itself saying that Bush and Cheney are lying to us about fighting a war against terrorism. It should be obvious. So we all have a duty to examine the language, examine the propaganda, examine the things that are said to us, and to become educators ourselves, whether we're teachers or parents or neighbors or wherever we work, and we have to try to give some history and tell the truth in a way that will help prepare our fellow citizens to resist any further exhortation to war. I mean, this is a, you know, sometimes people say, well, and I've heard this said, yes, to me, oh, you're anti-American. No, you got it wrong. Bush is not America. Cheney is not America. Congress is not America. The Supreme Court is not America. The people are America. The government may be anti-American. The government may be anti-American. You know. Well, America stands for a set of principles. Principles of the Declaration of Independence, that governments are set up to ensure that there's an equal right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And according to the Declaration of Independence, when governments become destructive of these ends, this is the language of the Declaration, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish the government. Really? That's the Declaration of Independence. Declaration of Independence is not anti-America. So, there's an important thing for all of us to do. We shouldn't be intimidated, even though we may run risks. The school kids may be suspended. A teacher may lose his job. Your neighbors may not like what you do. Or the FBI may visit you, really. The FBI has visited people because they've heard that this person, this really happened, this person had a poster in her room. Who reported her? The plumber? The person had a poster in her room, which was anti-Bush. She was visited by the FBI. No. So things may happen, but this is, our job is to resist on the supposition that, yeah, we will run risks, but if we stick at it, Our numbers will grow. This is how social movements develop. At first, they look hopeless. At first, the power of the authorities looks really invulnerable. But keep this in mind. The power of governments depends on the obedience of people. When people stop obeying, governments lose their power. Just as corporations are all powerful, if their workers go on strike, or if their consumers don't buy their products, they lose their power. So, people seem powerless until, and then people lose and lose. People struggle and lose. But if they keep on, if they persist, a point comes when their power becomes great enough that governments must pay attention. And governments must change their policies. And that's how victories have been won in the past for black people, for working people, for women, for anti-war people. And that's how victories have been won in other countries where it seemed people had no chance because they were living under tyrannies. But no matter how strong the tyrant and how powerful the military force, the tyrant wakes up in the morning and there are a million people in the streets and the soldiers will not obey. And the tyrant gets into a helicopter and flees, you see. And there should be a helicopter waiting for George Bush somewhere, you see. So I'm happy on this Veterans Day to bring you a message of conscientious objection, of civil disobedience, of peace, and of that kind of heroism that goes along with determining to make this a better country and a good society. Thank you. So there's a mic, and so any of you who want to ask a question or make a comment, you can come up to this mic. You're there.
Test.
920 miles, okay, to get here.
How many miles?
920. By the way, we need doctor's excuses. Me and my son, we're full tomorrow.
Why don't you use the microphone, right?
We need doctor's notes for school tomorrow. We need a doctor's excuse, my son and I, to take to school tomorrow. My professor told me, I guess this is more a challenge to you. This is his book. He was fired from Indiana University. He's now teaching at Purdue, and he's scared. Hi, Deb. This is my 10-year-old. I hear the same information from you that he gives us every single week. But with a wife and kids to support, he's very scared. And he needs encouragement from you because he is the next generation of college professors out there. As soon as he published his book, this is called Corporatism. Y'all, oh man, you don't even wanna know what's in here. But this is, I have to hand deliver this to you in order not to be counted absent tomorrow, because I won't be home yet. I really wish you would encourage college professors who feel the way he does to take that risk and to stand up and to encourage their students to take that risk. This one here, I got bounced out of his school. He took a Leatherman tool to school. This little 2-inch tool is considered a lethal weapon if you put it in the hands of a principal, okay? They found it on Friday. They called me on Monday, and they wanted to suspend him for 3 days because they have a no-tolerance policy. I teach my kids tolerance. They teach them no tolerance. Don't use any common sense. Don't use any good judgment. Just kick them out, but not until after I steps are over because his scores were so high. They needed that. I need to deliver this. I also like a couple autographs.
Oh, thank you. Well, your son is getting terrific education. Corporatism, The Secret Government of the New World Order by Jeffrey Grupp. Well, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Zarin. I've thought hard through a lot of what you just shared with us this afternoon. And in my own experience, for every adventure, human adventure, with regards to wars and with regards to something as the discovery of America, the Ottoman Empire and the Roman Empire, and the colonization of Africa and the tribal wars, in the context of all that, there's one common thread that runs through, and it seems to me that there's something in the human spirit, like you talk about government not having our interests at heart. There's something in the human spirit that always ventures to serve that interest. So any group of people who have gone any place to conquer, to defeat, even among little tribes, there's always a group or there's something about the human spirit that kind of like try to serve a certain, serve some kind of interest. And with that, since institutions and government being one of them, is a collection of what we've come, people who are part of what we've come to call the human race, my question is, the fundamental issue here is really more so with what is it with us as human beings that prevents us from living in a peaceful coexistence with each other?
We're getting the most profound questions. Well, you're asking about human nature, right? I believe that there is a mistaken notion among many people, and it's something that is encouraged by the powers that be. The mistaken notion is that there is some innate drive towards violence, aggression, war. It's hard to have any discussion on war without somebody at some point in the discussion saying, well, war is human nature. However, I don't believe this at all. They point to the reason very often given for the idea that war and aggression, violence, part of human nature, is that there's been so much war, been so much aggression. Well, it's proved by history. Not quite. Because history registers all sorts of behavior by human beings. History registers violent behavior, registers peaceful behavior. History shows people acting in brutal ways, it shows people acting in compassionate ways. People seem to have a capacity for very wide range of behaviors. And I would argue, certainly in relation to war, you don't see people rushing spontaneously into war. You don't see war initiated by people. You see war initiated by political leaders, who then mobilize the population with an enormous barrage of propaganda to go to war. If people had inherently a martial spirit, something drives them to war, governments would not have to work so hard. They would not, you know, Woodrow Wilson had to send 75,000 lecturers around the country to deliver 750,000 speeches, and they had to build up an atmosphere of patriotism and war and the evil on the other side. They have to go to tremendous lengths. They have to draft people. They have to force people. They have to entice people. Guys don't rush into, women don't rush into the military because they love war. No, they have to be enticed into it. They have to be told, you're fighting for this and you're fighting for that and you're fighting for that. In other words, they have to be told lies. And they have to be given inducements. So when I see the lengths to which governments have to go to get people to go to war, I know that war does not come out of, you know, some initial drive inside human beings. And that means that we have a great responsibility, and our responsibility is to speak to that which is in people, which I really believe is in people, which is fundamentally a desire to live at peace with other people. I really believe that people are, if there's anything inherent in people, although they can be propagandized to go to war, that people basically want to live in peace and people want to be in a neighborly way towards other people. They have to be driven to violence and war. They have to be driven by the conditions of their lives, by desperation, by propaganda. So I think there's something encouraging about the fact that governments have to go to such great lengths to get people to go to war. Yes.
And I'm just going to ask that anyone who comes up to ask a question, please speak directly into the microphone so we can all hear you. Thank you.
Like this? Thanks for coming to speak to us, first of all. I just got finished the past couple of weeks hearing about, for instance, there's a new book out. It's not a plug, but a book called American Fascist. It's talking about...
What's that?
It's a book called by Christopher Hedges.
Christopher Hitchens.
Hedges.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's Chris Hedges.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
It's about the rise of the right wing, particularly the Christian right wing. And I keep hearing and seeing examples of how they're so well organized. I'd like to hear your take on, is that inherent to the right-wing ideology, why they're so organized, if there's any way us on the left can be at least as well organized without negating our visions of what social justice is all about? Okay. I'm seeing him as, well, first he's redefining the evangelicals as dominionists, meaning that basically the way I took it to mean was with God on their side, they can do no wrong, just as you had said with people's positions on war and their and patriotism. We're the good guys, they're the bad guys, and we can do no wrong, even though we're behaving like bad guys. Now... Among reading things about the Christian right, or the right-wingers in general, how they've come to power and how to maintain that power, we see how they've been very organized over long periods of time to get that power and maintain that power. Could you explain, I'd like to hear your take on why you think they're so well organized versus those of us on the left in the past 20, 30 years.
Why the fundamentalist right is so well organized? They have a lot of money. Let's see. We're all capable of organizing. The left is as capable of organizing as the right, but they have a lot of money. They control a lot of radio stations and television stations and newspapers, and so you get the impression that, you know, oh, they must be better organized. Well, they are well organized, and yet they're failing. If their message is that this war is good, they're failing, it's the whole relationship of religion and the Bible and Christian fundamentalism to war. You know, is a very interesting one, because after all. You know, you have fundamentalists on both sides. You have fundamentalists who are in favor of war and supporting the government. You have other people who look at the Bible and say, "Thou shalt not kill." You know, I'm just reading about Bush meeting with the families of young people who died in Iraq. I don't know. Maybe some of you saying saw the same story in the New York Times. It was suggested that that the families that he was meeting with were carefully selected, so that you know, they come away saying, "Oh well, it was great to meet the president." There were others who apparently they weren't that carefully screened, because several of them who met the president and said, president could not convince them that their sons who had died in war had died for a good cause. But there was one point at which Bush was consoling a woman whose son had died, and he said, well, if you believe in the scriptures, then you know that your son will return. Well, that's real consolation. You know, But the woman did not say to him, as far as I know, if you believe in the scriptures and if you believe in the Ten Commandments, you will not send my son to war or any other son to war. So, you know, there are... You know, religious people have always been on all sides of political questions. You know, they've been crusaders for war, and they have been civil disobedience for peace.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you for coming today. It's really an honor to hear you speak. I assume you're familiar with the case of Marion Lordy and Norman Finkelstein at DePaul University?
I'm sorry. Either the mic is distorting your voice or my ears.
Can you hear me now? The cases of Norman Finkelstein and Marion Lordy at DePaul University? I was just wondering if you could share your thoughts on that with respect both to how the administration there behaved and the reaction of the students.
The normal people sign up
there. Yes.
Oh, okay. How many of you have heard of Norman Finkelstein? It's a very popular issue, you can see that. Yeah, I'll deal with it very, very quickly. Norman Finkelstein is a teacher and writer who is very critical of Israel in its occupation of, you know, the West Bank and Gaza. And he's a very no-holds-barred professor and speaker. It doesn't hold anything back, and the result is that he has incurred the wrath of a lot of people who disagree with him, and he has been dismissed from his job, from his teaching job, as a result of all sorts of pressure from people who dislike what he says about Israel and about the occupation. And I mean, Alan Dershowitz, for instance, who's, you know, very much a supporter of Israeli policies, Alan Dershowitz entered the fray and apparently had a certain amount of force behind him in helping to get this professor dismissed from his job. And I think now it's over in the sense that he, you know, he has left that university, right? But it's certainly an example of the fact that it is very, very difficult. And I mean, here the educational world is supposed to be a world of free marketplace of ideas. It never has been that. The university has always been exaggerated as a place for freedom. Teachers with dissenting ideas have always been in trouble. Administrations of universities, after all, universities are businesses, really. Universities are subject to trustees and money and corporations. And so, you know, we have an endless job of defending the right of free speech in that arena where you're supposed to have free speech, and that is the classroom and the university. And this is an example of it.
Thank you.
So last question.
Last question. Professor Zinn, I'm seeking your advice on a practical, political matter of local importance. I'm asking it publicly because other people may have suggestions too if they hear the question. A dozen yards from here is a truly beautiful monument, Worcester Memorial Auditorium, which was built as a monument to people who died in World War I, which you started your talk in. It was built in 1932. This is its 75th anniversary. Over the past decade and a half or so, the city has allowed it to die It's now empty and not being used, the dead body of a homeless person who had been squatting in part of the building was found there recently. My question is, it's going to take millions of dollars to renovate and restore this magnificent building.